Sometime this month, millions of Americans will step into one of the most fraught places in our society, a middle school or high school cafeteria. Middle and high schools have a strict social pecking order, and the cafeteria is where it is most visible. The popular kids all sit at the same table, their perfect hair and clear skin proclaiming their superiority. The jocks are usually subdivided by sport. Soccer players are separate from swimmers. The football team has a few tables all to itself. The nerds, the geeks, the techies, however they identify, they congregate. And somewhere in the cafeteria, maybe off in a corner where they can hide, are the misfits. The kids who are a little too weird, or a little too intense, or a little too special needs to fit in. Maybe they are sitting one to a table as though they have the plague, which, socially speaking, they do. Woe betide the misfit who tries to sit with the popular kids. They'll be chased off, told that someone is sitting in that empty seat, or sneered at until the message is clear. How dare you sit in the place of honor? Don't you know who you are? Figuring out where to sit in the school cafeteria often comes down to a transactional view of friendship. What can this person do for me? Can they increase my social standing? Can they get me closer to that boy or girl I'm attracted to? Will they help me fit in on the team? Many friendships at this age transcend this kind of calculation, but you can't always guarantee that your true friends will have the same lunch period as you. And in their absence, sitting with people who can do something for you is a reasonable choice. It's much better than cringing on the margins with the misfits. It turns out that the school cafeteria is not so different from a first century dinner party. The social pecking order at one of these parties is also made visible in the seating arrangements. Men didn't sit at tables in the first century. They reclined on couches, propped on their elbows with their feet stretched out behind them. The Gospels sometimes describe Jesus as reclining at table, and that's what it refers to. The center couch in the banqueting room was the place of honor. The wealthiest guests, the most powerful, the ones holding the highest office would sit there. Sometimes, perhaps because powerful people are often busy, the most prominent guest arrived late to the dinner. Instead of seating him wherever there was space, the host asked the lowest-ranking man at the center couch to move. Having to give up a place of honor was shameful for that lower-ranking guest, but the host was willing, even eager, to embarrass another man because of what that most prominent guest could do for him. The host does a favor for the most honored guest, and the honored guest will reward him in some way. It's a transactional view of friendship. It's exactly why the host invited that prominent guest and why the guest accepted. They're both getting something out of this. They both gain honor and public respect. The host gets a favor. The prominent guest gets a person in his debt. It's not surprising for Jesus to urge these dinner guests to show some humility. Better not to take the place of honor, in case you presume too much and you wind up losing face. It's sensible advice. No one at that dinner party would disagree. It's what Jesus teaches next that's so shocking. He tells the host, "The next time you give a dinner, don't invite people based on what they can do for you. Invite the poor, the weak, the people whose physical needs will inconvenience you, guests who can't possibly offer you anything in return. Invite the people who will never deserve to be the guests of honor at a dinner party." Jesus rejects the notion of friendship as a transaction. Instead of befriending people who can do something for you, befriend the people no one else wants to be friends with. It's like telling the prom king and queen to invite the most pathetic misfit in the entire school to sit at the popular kids' table. This is outrageous. The world doesn't work this way. This kind of thing would never happen. But isn't that exactly what God has already done for each one of us? The psalmist writes, "Lord, you have searched me out and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You discern my thoughts from afar. Indeed, there is not a word on my lips, O Lord, but you know it altogether." That's a comforting image and also a disturbing one. God's thorough, complete knowledge of each of us sees us as we truly are. God sees the poverty of our hearts. God sees the uncharitable thoughts of our minds. God sees our weakness, our flaws, our secrets. God sees our true condition and knows there is no favor we could ever do for God. There's nothing we could ever do that would make us worth God's while. That is the state of being human. God knows that we could never deserve to be the guest of honor at that dinner party, yet God seats us at the center couch. We might hang back, but God says, "No, I really mean it. This place is for you." We might protest, "I don't deserve to be here." And God simply smiles and fills our plate. We're all poor and limping, blind to what is truly important, crippled by our sins and our scars, and God still guides us to the place of honor. That invitation is made real in the bread and wine of Eucharist. Here, God plans a feast. Here, God lays the table and prepares bread and wine. Here, God leads us to the seat reserved for the most important guest. God doesn't bother asking whether we deserve it, because no one can possibly deserve God's self-giving love. God simply asks us to open our hands, then feeds us with the bread of life and the cup of salvation. It is God's joy to feed us. It is God's delight to meet us at this table. This is what God does for us, as Lutheran pastor David Lowes observes, creating us, giving us what we need to flourish, caring for us, forgiving us, redeeming us, even though we can do nothing meaningful for God in return. In fact, about the only thing we can do in return, when you think about it, is to share what we've been given with others. Whether we are in school or long since graduated, there are cafeterias in our lives, places where the pecking order is made visible. It might be an actual cafeteria at school or a workplace. It might be a shopping mall or an airport. It might be some other context in our neighborhood, any place where differences of wealth, status, and power are visible. What we can do for God is look in the corners of those cafeterias for the people who don't fit in, the ones who are a little too weird or a little too intense, the people whose income or skin color or orientation or disability puts them at a disadvantage in our society, the ones whom no one loves. And we can do what we can to share what God has given us. We can give up our seat at the popular kids' table to make room for them. We can stare down the sneering and the snubs and offer instead something of the grace we have received. None of us deserves to be the guest of honor at God's dinner party. We can't possibly repay God for the goodness and love God has shown us. What we can do in return, what we must do, is to love others as God has loved us.